Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
The effort to decarbonize our economy in California and throughout the world is extremely difficult. It's a tall hill that we're climbing. And there is a struggle and there is opposition. It's fair to say that the opposition coming from the oil companies, lobbying against it, I understand they're selling a fuel that ultimately has to be reduced substantially as we go forward to have a climate that we can all live in. There's a lot of talk about disadvantaged communities. No one is more disadvantaged when you're in the Central Valley or East Los Angeles or Riverside or Imperial County or San Bernardino, and the air is so poisonous.
Governor Jerry Brown celebrating the passage of a pair of major climate change bills this week. The bills he is signing into law extend California's ambitious effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions into the year 2030. The state will have to slash emissions to 40% below 1990 levels by then. It barely passed the state assembly after failing altogether last year. And it passed this time because lawmakers from more working class, Latino, and inland communities got on board. Joe Matthews wrote about this in his column Connecting California for Zocalo Public Square, and he's here now. Welcome, Joe.
Great to be with you, Mel.
The bill we're talking about, SB 32, was a hard sell for some Democrats. Why was it a hard sell? This is a state that is ruled by Democrats.
True, but there is some strong opposition on this. And, you know, oil still is a significant business in the state. We're still the home state of Chevron. Mm-hmm. And, you know, last year, certainly in part because of changes we made in how we elect officials and how we finance campaigns, there are a number of sort of more moderate Democrats that get a fair amount of money from oil and other energy interests and who didn't want to go this far last year. I mean, there was also legislation that would have reduced petroleum use significantly. And that's a big and complicated conversation. And, you know, in the broader context, California is still in North America. We're not actually an island. And, you know, the energy industry in North America is booming. So, you know, I think that felt probably for political, financial, campaign funding reasons, and also larger energy policy reasons like a bridge too far. The context here was a little bit different. It was narrower. And there had been a much bigger effort by people who believe in this legislation to broaden and reinvigorate their coalition around this legislation.
Well, let's talk about that coalition. You wrote about two lawmakers who embody what you're talking about. One is Fran Pavli. She is, of course, the mother of climate change legislation. She wrote the first bill, I think, in the nation about a decade ago. And the other is a relative newcomer, Eduardo Garcia from Coachella. Talk about how their alliance was behind this new legislation.
Right. Well, there are two things going on. One, and you heard Governor Brown reference it, is this notion that people who represent a lot of poor and particularly inland regions in California are asking, you're going to reduce greenhouse gases, but how, you know, what can I point to in my community, in my district that shows change? So what's happened here is a broadening of trying to judge climate change legislation not by reductions in greenhouse gases, not just by that, but also by metrics around public health. Is it also sort of helping reduce pollution in these inland places? And is it creating economic opportunities, jobs and new companies and et cetera? So Senator Pavli reached out to Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon was saying, you know, who should I be working with as I go forward in legislation? She also is leaving legislature. She's finally termed out at the end of this year. So I think she was also looking kind of for a successor. And Rendon pointed her to this completely obscure, really, until this week, assemblyman who's 39 years old, very sort of unfussy, rumpled guy who looks younger than 39, is the former mayor of Coachella named Eduardo Garcia. When I first became aware of him, is he showed up in a photo of the California delegation to the Paris climate talks back in December. And I'd never seen this guy. I thought he might be a staffer. He's with all these much older politicians, but who turns out to be, and I spent some time with him, a really skilled and gifted, detail-oriented legislative mechanic, just who's quite good and is in a lot of ways very much like Pavley. They both came out of local government, mayors very young in their lives of their towns. So Pavley's from Agoura Hills. So they've made this alliance. They co-authored each other's bills, including these two big bills that were approved yesterday. And they have sort of reinvigorated and broadened this coalition together, often going to people. It's sort of a Mutt and Jeff act and meeting people together, the two of them.
But they have different philosophies when it comes to climate change or different viewpoints.
I think so. I mean, there's certain points of emphasis. I mean, Pavley, you know, created this regime on that involves capping, and now, you know, what was done yesterday was putting the law a much tighter cap on greenhouse gases by 2030 than her previous landmark legislation, 2006. Garcia is much more in the line of, I want to see what this climate change legislation and the related investments and regulation can do for the poor part of California I represent, and he has a you know, some of the very poorest parts of California. And he's the giant chunk of the southeast corner of the state. His district borders both Arizona and Mexico, and, you know, the huge district. So that's what matters for them. They also do have things in common. They're both pretty grounded, very detail-oriented, and similarly unfussy. And I think that's important at some level. The judgment's been made by people in this. It's good to have someone like that kind of backstopping and sweating the details, because a lot of the rhetoric in this area comes from pretty fussy and fancy people in the Bay Area whose feet never touch the ground. And both Pavley and Garcia are people who are deeply grounded in their own communities, the San Fernando Valley and the inland deserts. You know, they're not necessarily the places we associate with environmentalism in this state.
Right. So his concern, as you said earlier, is about green jobs, but also about air quality. And in his part of the state, the air quality is pretty bad because of all that agriculture. What exactly would this new legislation do to improve the air quality in the poorer parts of California?
It remains to be seen. You know, obviously the greenhouse gas stuff may have the ancillary benefit of improving air quality, but a lot depends on how the legislation that he really championed, the AB 197, which creates a sort of oversight committee in the legislature to look at, that's supposed to sort of guarantee that benefits are flowing to these places. That means there'll be some tension and fighting with the California Air Resources Board, and that's why this sort of unknown assemblyman is obviously going to have a big role in those details and in this legislative committee and sort of overseeing this, and he's really a person to watch. It really depends how, if he can rise to this sort of challenge, and I don't think it will be, it won't be easy, and it will not come together fast.
However, he has a powerful ally, Kevin De Leon, whose district includes a lot of freeway interchanges and a lot of poor people and a lot of high pollution levels. So
That's true. But remember, part of the tension, now that we're very much a one-party state, Democratic dominance, Kevin De Leon's in the Senate. He's the Senate President Pro Tem, so he's the Senate. Assemblyman Garcia is in the Assembly, and a lot of the fighting and difficulty now in Sacramento is Assembly versus Senate. One of the reasons for this alliance between Senator Pavley and Assemblyman Garcia was to reduce that fighting on this issue, and I think what happened yesterday in terms of the passage says that they've had some success in that. Assemblyman Garcia's real patron is the Assembly Speaker, Anthony Rendon, also here from the Los Angeles area, and a big part of Assemblyman Garcia's job in making this work going forward is to make sure both his superior, the Speaker, and Senator De Leon are sort of all on the same page, and that he, you know, he's probably got to be very careful to stay on the right side of Senator De Leon going forward.
Joe Matthews writes the Connecting California column for Zocalo Public Square. Joe, thank you.
My pleasure.
All right, we want to hear from you. What do you think the state should be doing more of when it comes to fighting air pollution? How has air pollution affected your life? Give us a comment on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, California's Common Core school scores are out, and there are massive discrepancies along racial lines. We'll talk about that. Also, the argument for a money-back guarantee for college. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program, Morning Becomes Eclectic, can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We now have more proof that California is struggling when it comes to race, education, and closing the achievement gap. New standardized test results came out this week, and the racial divide between the lowest and highest scores is remarkable. Black students had the lowest scores of any group. About a third met grade-level standards in English. Fewer than 20% were proficient in math. Compare that to the highest scoring group, Asian Americans, where roughly 70% met or exceeded the standards. The tests are based on the Common Core learning standards. They're supposed to measure whether students are on track to be college ready, and so the implications could be far-reaching. Tyrone Howard is here now. He's an education professor at UCLA who studies racial inequity in schools, and he's the author of the book Expanding College Access for Urban Youth: What Schools and Colleges Can Do. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Madeline. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Why this huge gap? Why are Black students in particular being left behind? They are being left behind Latinos as well when it comes to these scores.
Yeah, this is disturbing because while we know these gaps have existed, I don't think anyone in their right mind thought the gaps were this big in Los Angeles. And I think it really comes down to just our refusal to really have a long, hard, and honest conversation about how race and racism still exists in our schools and in our society writ large. And I think when it comes to Black and Latino students in particular, we don't want to have conversations about the ways in which institutional racism and systemic racism still play out and the kinds of attitudes and preconceived notions that a lot of educators have about certain students. So until we have that conversation and we have it in a real thoughtful and honest and ongoing manner, I don't think we're going to see any real significant change in these disparities.
Right. And this isn't new in terms of disparities. It's just the numbers are particularly stark when you look at them on paper. And in Los Angeles, they're even lower than they are across the state on the statewide averages. So happening here?
What's happening here, I think, is really a couple of factors. I think, one, you have to take into account the fact that Los Angeles has a disproportionately high number of Latino and African American students. So that's going to explain a lot. But I think we also see a higher degree of students who are qualifying for free and reduced lunch, and we know that students who are poor tend to not do well in schools as well. So when you bring that nexus of race and poverty together in large quantities like we have here in Los Angeles, I think you're going to see the ways in which this plays itself out different compared to other cities across the state.
Mm. Well, your book looks at schools that have been successful in closing the achievement gap, and I'm wondering if you could give us some examples of things that L.A. could be doing, California could be doing, to try to close the achievement gap.
I think one of the things that we found that's really intriguing in our work is that we first found schools that were willing to have strong leaders who acknowledge the fact that there were racial discrepancies. And I think leadership is a big part of this solution. Leaders who are willing to take a look at data along racial and ethnic lines and say, we have a problem. And once we recognize and acknowledge that we have a problem, what we also found is that these schools and these principals in particular were willing to have ongoing training around unconscious bias, to look at the ways in which certain attitudes and beliefs that teachers held were not conducive to all students' learning. I mean, there's research, for example, by Seth Gershenson that looks at the fact that non-black teachers typically have significantly lower expectations for black students than black teachers do. So what we found was that these teachers, or these leaders at these schools, were willing to have these conversations to engage their staff in ongoing training and professional development to help them come to grips with some of the ways they may have been viewing students of color, black and Latino students in particular, to see how they can address those kinds of attitudes, how they can change those low expectations. And when you take those steps, then you begin to see some different ways in which these teachers engage with their students, the ways they provide them opportunities to learn, how they keep those students a part of the learning environment. And when you do those things, you see a different type of outcome for students that you would not see otherwise.
And do black and Hispanic teachers also have lower expectations for black and Hispanic students?
In some cases, we have found there is research that suggests that they do, but not nearly to the degree to which we find that white teachers do. And so that's the other big elephant in the room that we have to discuss, that issues around bias tends to be much greater among white teachers than it does among teachers of color. And so given the fact that we have such a large number of teachers of color in our schools, there's a willingness to have that, there's got to be a willingness to have this conversation. And that's not to say that all white teachers subscribe to these lowered expectations of black students, but there are lots of them who hold high expectations for black students, and those students do well. But we do know there's a disproportionate number of white teachers and other teachers who are not really honest about the ways in which they see black and Latino students.
How does segregation fit into this?
That's a good question. I mean, segregation is always a factor, and it's been lots of research on some of the challenges and some of the limitations of segregation. But what we know is that even if you have segregated schools, this comes down to high-quality teaching and how do we put the teachers in classrooms that are not affected by the ways in which we know sort of notions of anti-blackness or anti-Latinoness play out in our society writ large. I think what we see in L.A. is really no different than what we see in large cities across the country. So segregation is rampant. Segregation is real, no doubt. And part of what we have to understand is that even in those segregated communities, we still need strong schools that are girded by strong leaders and highly qualified, culturally competent, and racially aware teachers.
Well, in L.A., we have a new superintendent, and I know she's just new and just started the job, but how do you think that she's faring so far?
Yeah, I think the jury's still out. Superintendent King is still new, and you've got to realize there's so many layers, and it's such a big behemoth that LAUSD is. So I think we've got to give her time to really to get her proposals and agenda clarified and where she's going to go. But I'm optimistic. I'm hopeful. I think that these data right here tell us that we still have a long way to go, because even though the spin has been that the scores are up this year compared to last year, which is true, I think the bigger, the more compelling, the more disturbing story is just the widening gap that we see between black, Latino, and Asian and white students. And that's got to be something that's got to be at the forefront of not only her agenda, but as well as the board of the district as well.
One of her solutions is to increase magnet school offerings. Do you think that's a good idea that could go towards closing the gap?
So I'm one who doesn't necessarily believe that magnet school or schools of choice or charter schools have a particular advantage or a better effectiveness on outcomes. I'm one who believes that you can have magnet schools, but if you still got the kind of teaching and teachers that are in place in non-magnet schools, it won't make a difference. So I think we've got to be willing to, again, focus on the quality of teaching. We have to look at the way in which teachers are prepared before they even step foot into schools. And we have to also look at the manner in which we are continuing to provide high-quality professional development to teachers in big schools, small schools, charter schools, magnet schools, no matter what they may look like.
Well, teachers sometimes balk at being the primary point person in these discussions, saying, look, there are lots of other reasons why students are failing. It's not just because of what's happening in the classroom. There's lots of stuff going on outside the classroom.
And I think that's a fair response. I'm a former classroom teacher myself, and there's no doubt that teachers do get, an unusually and unfair part of the criticism. When you talk about student outcomes, there are lots of layers that we have to take into account, because schools are only one part of that process. I mean, at some point in time, we have to look at the ways in which schools engage parents and caregivers in the process of preparing young people for school before they even start this process. So, yes, we have to look at our communities. We have to look at the supports that we have writ large. But I think these test scores obviously points the finger in the direction of what's happening in schools. But by no means can we say that 100% of the blame lies with what happens with teachers. But there is a part of that that we do have to acknowledge, and we have to find ways to address it.
Well, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Tyrone Howard. He's an education professor at UCLA and author of the book Expanding College Access for Urban Youth, What Schools and Colleges Can Do. And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think schools and colleges can do? What do you think LA schools in particular should be doing to better educate all students and close the achievement gap? Leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Well, from primary ed to higher ed now, and a new idea to disrupt the way we pay for college degrees. What if a degree came with a money-back guarantee? Many colleges are already promising big returns on investment, jobs after graduation, networking, a shiny path to success, lots of carrots. No sticks, though, if those promises don't pan out. Brookings Institution fellow Beth Akers has taken up the idea of a money-back guarantee on degrees. Her op-ed recently appeared in Time magazine and has generated a ton of buzz. Welcome, Beth.
Thanks for having me.
Well, these days it costs a lot to go to college. 4 years can cost more than many U.S. households earn in an entire year. And there is that implicit promise that if you spend the money, you'll get something back. You'll get a better life, in effect. But that doesn't always pan out, right?
That's exactly right. So, you know, when you look at the statistics on higher education, what we see is that on average, these degrees are totally worth it. So, of course, there are groups of people for whom we know it's not. But generally speaking, this is a good investment. And so a lot of times what I talk about is that we're really misplacing the discussion when we talk about growing debt and growing price in higher ed. What we should be talking about is growing risk. And that's that we have some people who are making this large investment and maybe through no fault of their own are just not seeing that return.
But maybe it's through no fault of the college either. Maybe it's forces in the larger economy.
Absolutely. So, you know, we could try to generate policies that try to parse out who's at fault. But I think it's more helpful from a public policy perspective and from, you know, in an institutional policy perspective to just say, look, there's a lot of risk in this game, and let's start looking at solutions for how to address that, both from a policy level, but also from what we talked about in the op-ed, which is the institution level. And to me, what's super exciting about what we wrote about was that there is this set of institutions who are recognizing that risk is something that their potential students are really worried about. And they're responding to that by providing this as, in some cases, an option, and in some cases, a feature of their educational program.
Well, talk a little bit more about that. There's one at SUNY Buffalo.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So we highlighted a few examples, but of course, what's always fun about publishing is that you then learn to find about all the other examples that mm-hmm. exist. But SUNY Buffalo is one example of a guarantee program that we talked about. What they do is they're not offering a money-back guarantee, but what they're doing is trying to address the concern that students have about not being able to graduate on time. So you might have heard people talking in the past about having to stay an extra semester because the courses they needed to take were oversubscribed. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this institution said, we recognize that this is something that you're worried about. So if you enter into this agreement with us, which, you know, has the student participating in certain advising programs and having to declare a major on time and all these things, what we guarantee you is that if you can't graduate on time and it's our fault, we're going to pay your tuition until you graduate.
Oh, and have students taken them up on that?
You know, last I spoke to them about it, which is a little while ago, what happens is that they actually haven't had to pay out. So the students have enrolled in the program. There's a lot of interest among students. But once the students carry their side of the bargain, which is to participate in sort of a rigorous advising program, at that particular institution, what they found is that the barriers of class availability and things sort of are no longer a problem. And so in that case, it's actually created a nice alignment of incentives for the institution to make sure that the classes are available for students and for the students to do what they really need to do in order to get through the program on time.
So there are other examples of different ways of doing this. None for an explicit money-back guarantee, though, right?
Yeah. So the idea is more that they're guaranteeing something, and if they fail to produce that for the student, then the student gets something in return. And each of the institutions has really created a different sort of program. So Buffalo, was operating on the guarantee around an on-time graduation. The other programs are talking about employment guarantees, so guaranteeing that the student gets a job in their field of choice after graduation. Others are looking at explicitly earnings, so saying if you don't reach this earnings threshold in your first job after school, we'll kind of supplement your earnings to make up the difference. So it's not necessarily a straight tuition-back guarantee, although Udacity is actually operating on a model similar to that. But really, these institutions have designed programs that very specifically meet the needs of the students that they're trying to serve.
But what if they just lower the cost of tuition? Then they wouldn't have to do that.
They could do that. I think what the institutions might argue is, you know, look, on average, we're providing a service that's worth it in the long run. So, you know, sometimes they say the reason that the price tag for higher ed is high is because the value is high, at least on average. So the problem we want to solve is not necessarily the price, but it's the fact that the price sometimes is not worth it. And so that's what these institutions are doing. They're saying, if it turns out to be worth it, you're going to pay the high price because that's kind of how markets work. And if it doesn't, we're going to make you whole again.
And what is the latest thinking on whether or not college is worth it?
Well, so, you know, it's sort of a hard question to answer because ideally we'd love to look into the future and see how are today's students faring into the future. The best we can do is look backwards. And all of the estimates on the financial returns to degrees suggest that, you know, on a return on investment way of measuring, that they're actually doing quite well. So the estimated rate of return on a bachelor's or an associate's degree has been steady at about 15%. And so think of that in comparison to something that might be in your stock portfolio. That's a pretty fantastic return, especially because these students are able to borrow from the federal government at low interest rates to make that investment.
What about the idea that this isn't a consumer product, that this is more something that is something that's less tangible, that it's a public good, it's an experience, it's something to make you a better human, not mm-hmm. necessarily something that can translate into dollars and cents?
Yeah, so this is a viewpoint that creates a lot of dissonance in this discussion about higher ed. So we have a community of people largely coming from really traditional institutions of higher education talking about just what you said, which is that higher education is something that's sort of intangible, immeasurable, and therefore you just can't create a contract about whether or not they fulfilled their promise. On the other hand, we have surveys that report when you ask students why they're going to college, they tell you the number one reason, the majority of them tell you that the number one reason is to better themselves financially and to get a better job, to have a higher earnings. So it's absolutely true that some segments of our higher ed market are focused on this less tangible or less measurable experience, but there are other institutions that are serving these students for whom the primary goal is vocational, is to find a better job, to have a higher income, and to be able to just be better off financially. And so what's great about our higher ed system is that we have a lot of diversity across institutions. A lot of times we kind of forget that in the conversation, but I think it's possible to have both. So we have institutions that are serving these students who care an awful lot about these tangible financial outcomes, and also institutions that it would be completely implausible for them to offer a guarantee because what they're offering is just not doesn't have necessarily a measurable outcome.
Beth Akers is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Her book about student debt comes out next month. It's called Game of Loans. That is a very snazzy title. Thanks, Beth.
Thanks so much.
All right, I want to hear from you. Do you think colleges should have a money-back guarantee? Do you think they should have any guarantees? Tell us what you think on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the secret parts of Koreatown, like gay cruising in Korean spas.
He told me that he had a hot hookup with a guy in the steam room of a Korean spa. Like, that sounded totally sacrilegious to me because it had just been this place where I would scrub myself next to these old Korean dudes.
The director of the feature film Spa Night, it's about a teenager figuring out his identity in a traditional Korean culture. That's next on Press Play.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Koreatown is a sprawling, urban, polyglot of an area, and it's LA's densest neighborhood. These days, it's home to immigrants from just about everywhere, but Koreans have been coming there since the 1960s to take a swing at the American dream. One Korean family living in Koreatown seems to have struck out, however. They're at the center of a new feature film called Spa Night. Their mom-and-pop restaurant has failed, and their mild-mannered teenage son takes a job to help out, cleaning up at an all-male Korean spa. What he sees there opens his eyes to who he really is, even if that means not being who his parents expect him to be. Joining me now in the studio, the film's writer and director of Spa Night, Andrew Ahn. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And Joseph Suh is the film's star. Welcome.
Hello.
To you. Thanks for coming in. So this is a story about a young man discovering his sexuality, but it also seems to be mainly more so about a son trying to live up to his parents' expectations.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting as I was developing the screenplay, I really was focusing on this kind of sexual coming of age in the setting of a Korean spa that has a strong culture of underground gay cruising. But what I realized was that what I was interested in more was this intersection between my gay and Korean American identity. And that meant having to see what my Korean identity is. And that's very wrapped up in family. Mm-hmm. So as I developed the screenplay more, the parent characters became a bigger and bigger part of the script. And seeing it now, I really see it as a family movie, you know, not a family movie, but right. A movie about a family.
And they're all trying to deal with their shifting identities. Because the dad, who was the breadwinner, or at least he was the one who was at the center in a traditional sense, running and owning this restaurant, no longer does that because the restaurant has failed.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I thought of David as this character as being someone who's trapped between being a boy and a man. And then at the same time, I was thinking about the parents and their transition from, you know, being able-bodied breadwinners to, you know, maybe at some point they're going to have to rely on their child. And that's a scary moment, I think. And I was also really fascinated in the immigrant experience, how, you know, as a second-generation Korean-American, my identity feels very solidly American, but it's really my parents who have a more complicated identity where they lived, you know, 20, 30 years in one country and then have lived another 30 years in a different country. And I think that that's a story that you don't hear very often.
And do you have a similar story, Joe? Do you, are you
similarly? Yes. I mean, like my parents came here and they had a restaurant also, but it wasn't a Korean restaurant. It was like a standard American diner type of restaurant. So we had like burritos.
In Koreatown?
Close to LA High School. So yeah.
So you grew up in Koreatown, but yeah. You did not, Andrew.
I grew up in Torrance, which might as well be a Koreatown because it's a very Korean American suburb. There's a large population there. My parents worked and have worked in Koreatown. I would spend a lot of time in Koreatown, especially during the summers.
Let's talk about the role of the spa in Korean culture. The opening of the movie, you see the entire family at a family spa, and David, the son, is scrubbing his dad's back.
it's a very family-oriented space. You know, it's a big part of Korean culture, and it's a very traditional kind of meeting place where you gather with family and you go with friends. It's a really Korean thing. And so, you know, when I found out through a friend, he told me that he had a hot hookup with a guy in the steam room of a Korean spa. Like, that sounded totally sacrilegious to me because it had just been this place where I would scrub myself next to these old Korean dudes. You know, I couldn't believe it.
Like, we don't think of it as hooking up. It's just more like a place where people go for hangovers, people go with their families. It's just a place of just rest. So it's really interesting on this whole underground, you know, culture of hooking up is taking place is just something that is really new to me.
Hmm. Yeah, I also didn't know about the hangover part, which is also in the movie.
Your
friends go out for a night of drinking, and you're like, oh, I gotta go.
Especially
to this
in
spot.
Korea. In Korea, it's like a hyper business, hyper like working culture. So anytime you have like 3 hours of time that you could like rest, you would go rest at a spa or like a jimjilbang, as they would say. But it's totally something that everyone does. Like, you know, like since the trains stop running at like 2 a.m., so they have to wait till the next train till like, which starts at 5. So they just kind of, during that time, hey, might as well drink and then just rest a little bit and go back to work. You know, it's pretty insane.
I think here in L.A., I mean, Korean spas have become kind of trendy. Like I see coupons on Groupon, you know, for We Spa. And I think it's really cool that people are getting exposed to Korean culture. But at the same time, like, you know, it's still also a very big part of the community. And, you know, my mom goes to the Korean spa probably once or twice a week, you know. And so the kind of utility of it mixed with the very Korean-ness of it, you know, it just goes against what I was exploring in Spa Night, you know, that there was this gay culture. And it's that intersection of these two things that I felt like could be a great setting and an opportunity to talk about, you know, what are the difficulties of being gay and Korean-American? Like, what are the places where they feel mutually exclusive?
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Andrew Ahn and Joseph Suh. They are the writer, director, and star of a new film called Spa Night. It opens this weekend at the Sundance Sunset Cinema. So after the restaurant fails in the movie, the mom needs to find work. And she's offered a job by a friend or someone she knows from her church, this wealthy woman. And there's this exchange. It's really painful where she offers the mom to work for her. Mm. And she set up the parameters of the relationship, the power dynamic of the relationship in that scene. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about that exchange as an example of some of the social pressure in the Korean community.
Yeah, I think there was a moment in the writing of the screenplay where I realized, you know, yes, this family that I'm showing in this film should have financial difficulties, but the biggest difficulty is trying to hide that, you know, wanting to show that they're doing well. And so there's this, you know, awkwardness of having to cover up and lie in order to save face and seem like you're, you know, a productive member of this church and this society and this community. And that moment in the film really shows this hierarchy of how people climb the social ladder. You know, I think that's every immigrant family's American dream, right? Is to be able to be successful and make roots in this new country. And if you haven't achieved that, it's a really difficult thing to express. I often see in the Korean newspaper these articles of, you know, successful young Korean Americans and, you know, this student got a 1600 on her SAT and she's going to Yale, you know, but we don't hear the more human stories. And that's something that I wanted to do with Spa Night.
And seeing a young man who is not going to go to college necessarily, who isn't a good student, that's transgressive in and of itself when you consider the cliches around Asian Americans and especially Korean Americans.
Yeah, and I think even my cousin, you know, like he dropped out of high school even. And it's just, there's a lot of things that happen within an Asian family. It's not always this, what's that called? Something, model minority. They're not the model minority. Mm-hmm. Asian Americans can also, you know, feel the burdens of financial and social pressures.
Is it more shameful, I wonder, in Korean culture to not do well academically or to be gay?
Oh, man. Well, okay. Oh. So, you know, I'll talk about this from a very personal place because that's the only way I know how to answer this question. But I will say I think I studied really hard in school. And, even in my filmmaking, tried to do my best in film because I was trying to make up for the fact that I was gay.
Now, is it difficult to be gay and Korean here in LA, in the Korean community?
Yeah, you know, I think there's some interesting things happening. So one is that the Korean-American community is particularly religious. It's very Christian. The other thing, too, is that so many people came over in the, you know, 70s and 80s. And so actually, in some ways, their mindset is still very conservative and stuck in that kind of Korean culture. And then for me, it's also this idea of, you know, as a Korean American, my Korean identity is very wrapped up in eating dinner with family and going to family parties and events, where the rest of my life is very American. And so if my one connection to my Koreanness is this very heteronormative family, a mother, a father, and a child, you know, if I can't have that family, you know, if I can't have a Korean wife who then has a Korean baby with me, am I less Korean because I'm gay? And that's a really scary and frustrating conclusion to come to. And I wanted to, in some way with Spawnite, try and forge some semblance of an authentically gay and Korean American culture, even if that means it's cruising at a spa.
Have your parents seen the movie?
My parents saw the film at Sundance. So we premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this past January, and they drove from Los Angeles to Park City, Utah with a van full of fruit and ramen noodles and
just in case there wasn't
snacks.
Any
just in case
Colorado,
we were hungry.
Yeah.
You know. His parents are just so great. They care for the whole, not just Andrew, but for the whole crew, for everyone. So,
and it was really nerve-wracking for me for them to see it for the first time. But I think they really responded to it because, again, it's this film about a family and the difficulties of being an immigrant family, and you just don't see that often. And I think that they could really connect to that. You know, and I also think they're a little glad that it wasn't like a porn, that I was trying to be tasteful and tell this story in a way that could appeal to a lot of different audiences. So I was nervous. It went well.
And Joe, what about you? What did your parents think?
They haven't seen the film yet, but then prior to the film, I told them what the story was about, and they were really encouraging. They were like, yeah, you know, you try your best. And from then I just jumped on board. I really want them to watch the film. Hopefully it'll happen on Friday or Saturday. We'll see.
Would you watch it with them?
I kind of don't want to watch it with them.
That's the worst. I have to say.
I kind of don't want to, but if they really need me to be there, like, I don't know. I haven't thought about that, but we'll see.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for coming in today.
Thank you so much.
Andrew Ahn is the writer and director of the new film Spa Night. Joe Suh is the film's star, and it opens in Los Angeles this weekend at the Sundance Sunset Cinema.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. And you can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brandt. It's Thursday, and that means one thing. Two words. Shani Jardin. And another two words, boing boing.
Hey, Madeline Brand, there's another two words, and thank you. Another two words. That's enough to fit in a tweet, all 8 or 16 of those words.
Excellent. And that's the way we should only communicate.
It is.
Okay. Let's talk about Leslie Jones, Saturday Night Live star, star of the NBC Olympics.
Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters star.
Wonderful, wonderful, fun woman. She has been the target of sustained and coordinated internet bullying, cyberbullying, most of it on Twitter until now. And this week it was revealed that her Apple iCloud account had been hacked. And the people attacking her put up nude photos, which may or may not be of Leslie Jones, and racist comments, like meme videos about Harambe the dead gorilla, implying that, you know, yeah. It was just awful, disgusting, yeah. Yucky stuff. Celebrities from Questlove to Katy Perry came to her aid. Lena Dunham was talking about it yesterday. I think, you know, it's not just among celebrities, but among reporters and just, you know, random women with low follower counts and big opinions. If you're out there and you attract the attention of someone like the creeps who follow Trump supporter Milo Yiannopoulos around, if you have an opinion and you're female and you break some taboo that they've created, many of them may pile on you and dox you, reveal intimate information about you, or hack your website, or you know, do other awful, awful things on and offline. It's a particularly ugly and sustained campaign. So
She in particular though has been the victim of this ugly and sustained campaign.
Yeah, and maybe part of that has to do with the fact that she was starring in a female-led reboot of the Ghostbusters mm-hmm. film, which was of course the original starred a bunch of funny guys. This one starred a bunch of funny women. So after the iCloud hack this week, there were reports. TMZ was the first, as they always are, Hollywood's best surveillance operation. They were the first to report about the Leslie Jones hack, and they reported or misreported that the FBI was involved. Then The Verge, Hollywood Reporter, and other publications came out and said it's actually not the FBI, but the Department of Homeland Security. A DHS spokesperson did confirm that they're looking into it, and that's kind of interesting. TMZ also checked police filings in Los Angeles with LAPD and in New York, NYPD, and said there's nothing, no police report filed yet. Jones is bicoastal.
Mm. Why DHS and not the FBI?
I don't really understand that. I mean, I suppose the national security interest in here, it's a bit of a stretch, but yeah, I've been watching a lot of cable news coverage of the presidential campaign this week. And, you know, with all of this new attention around the so-called alt-right, Breitbart, Steve Bannon now in a primo position in the Trump campaign, Milo Yiannopoulos is getting a lot of screen time as somebody who's also a representative of that social movement.
Now, he is an editor at Breitbart, and he was kicked off Twitter for harassing Leslie Jones in the first place.
That's right. Twitter banned him after he was confirmed to be essentially a ringleader of a sustained, targeted group cyberbullying efforts. It's kind of like a group of people declare war on somebody. And wouldn't you know it, they're often black or female.
So any idea that he might be behind this latest hack, or is that speculation?
Yeah, he took to Snapchat, which is his it's his Ecuadorian embassy in exile, if you will. it's where Milo set up shop after Twitter banned his account, and he posted a couple of Snapchat selfies with kind of coy messages indicating, gee, I couldn't possibly have known about this, which, of course, I guess are meant to suggest that he did. He is an interesting and anomalous character within the alt-right spectrum because he is an out gay man, mm-hmm. and he calls himself by some vulgar names for gay men. Like his tagline is this slur against gay men, saying he's the most dangerous, yes. We'll just say most dangerous gay man. But just as Trump is disrupting the Republican, you know, standards of decorum, it's like Milo is disrupting what's left of the Trump standard of decorum. And our entire country is a raging garbage fire that just won't stop. Help.
Okay. Where do we go from there?
I'm thinking to that new planet that they just found.
That's right.
Proxima, what was it?
It does need a rename, a rebrand.
I'm getting a Proxima condo.
Let's call it Boing Boing.
Okay.
You have a story on Boing Boing about the Baltimore Police Department using a spy plane.
Yeah.
What are they spying on? Why do they have a spy plane?
To keep an eye on citizens. Bloomberg Businessweek reported earlier this week about how the city of Baltimore, the Baltimore Police Department, has been using a single-engine Cessna aircraft outfitted with a special wide camera array, cameras that can see effectively in 360 degrees by being chained together in a special array. It was reported by Bloomberg that this was, in fact, leftover Iraq war technology.
Hmm.
And some details about that may or may not be classified, so I'm not going to talk too much about it, but I've been reading some defense documents that suggest that that's, this is another example probably of military technology used on foreign populations coming home to roost in America's police departments. So since January, there have been many, many hours of those flights, intermittent. And if you were a citizen of Baltimore, it would be very likely that you might have been caught by those aerial spy plane recordings at one point or another. The Bloomberg piece opens up by talking about what the scene was like outside of the Baltimore courthouse when all of the officers in the Freddie Gray police death case came up with not guilty verdicts. So everyone was considered not guilty in that case where a black man died in a so-called rough ride in a police mm-hmm. van. And one of the figures in that Bloomberg story said, you know, it's hard for me to believe that there wasn't footage because in Baltimore, the city is essentially filming everything all the time. And that man probably didn't know that this aerial surveillance has been going on. The city of Baltimore acknowledged it yesterday, basically, that the police chief and the mayor basically said, yep, but don't worry about it unless you're a criminal. And it was only a test. As I said, the country is a raging dumpster fire. Help.
Who are you going to call?
Leslie Jones.
Shelley Jardin, co-editor of boingboing.net. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
I'm going to call Julie Myers, who has returned from her vacation.
Yeah.
Welcome back.
I am back. And I have, guess what?
Feedback.
Okay, so our listeners really wanted to talk about the college thing, whether or not you should get a money back guarantee. Sharon Smith Fuderfoss on Facebook says that the education and experience you get from a traditional college is invaluable, despite the job you get out of school. And you can't, by definition, put a price on something that is invaluable.
Mm-hmm.
But Albert Rod on Twitter had another idea for making it work. And he says, what about having a minimum wage for certain college degrees? Lots of people weighing in today, Twitter and Facebook at KCRW Press Play.
All right. Hit us up there. Thank you, Julie Myers. Welcome back. Great to have you singing as well as talking. All right. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.